This is Cincinnati Edition. I'm Mark Haney. Coming up later in the program, we'll hear an interview I had with author Dorothy Christensen and civil rights leader Marion Spencer about her biography released last summer. But first,
let us not wallow in the valley of despair. I say to you today, my friend, so even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal.
More than 50 years have passed since the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. gave his I Have a Dream speech during the March on Washington. While we have seen advances in racial equality since then, a recent Gallup poll shows a majority of Americans regard tension between the races as one of the most serious challenges facing the nation today. Joining us to discuss what progress has been made and what still needs to be done to further racial equality in America as we celebrate the life and work of the civil rights leader on this Martin Luther King Day are National Underground Railroad Freedom Center President Dr. C.G. Newsom and Executive Vice President and Provost Dr. Michael Battle. And C.G. and Michael, thank you so much for being here
today. Thank you, Mark. Glad to be here with you.
I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. And that's another part of that famous speech that the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. gave. It was August 1963 at the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. C.G., how significant was that I Have a Dream speech to the civil rights movement?
Well, it was absolutely major because it was so inspirational that it moved so many people in this country to rethink the way we were living with each other and to envision the possibilities of how we could live better with one another, more harmoniously in the way of helping to create equal opportunities for all. It raised our sights. It lifted us up. It moved us to become more determined as a youth. My own sense of my personhood and sense of obligation to my community went to newer levels. I became more active in civic affairs at that point in time. I became more responsible for myself. I worked more to build relationships. And when I had a chance to do so, that was right around the time of desegregation, I worked to build relationships across racial lines.
Michael, how do you view the impact of that speech?
One of the most pressing elements of that speech is what precedes him talking about the hope for his four children. King was deeply American and was a deep believer in the strength of the American Constitution. Note he contexts his dream as a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. And what King often tried to do was bring America to the full sense of the consciousness about why we were founded as a nation based on the principles of freedom, liberty, and rights. And King always saw the inability of the American people to jump the hurdle of racial divide as being that an inability that prevents us from fully realizing what King thought God intended for America. So he talks about the American dream, and it is the American dream that calls for all people, without regard to their race, color, creed, orientation, to be able to sit at the same table with an equal sense of brotherhood. That was King, a deeply American person.
Michael, what was the state of race relations at the time Dr. King gave that speech?
Well, you know, I was quite a rebel and protester during that time. My brother and I would go out and stage individual protests, and I used to get mad because they wouldn't arrest me because I was too young to be arrested. But we would go to the Velvet Freeze ice cream place in our neighborhood that would not allow us to sit down at the counter to be served. And my brother and I would go and sit and demand to be served. They never served us, but they always ran us out. But it was a time that people just did not want to cross that divide of total acceptance. And there are pockets of that today. And I think God requires us, humanity requires us, common sense requires us at some point as a nation to jump that divide.
That was 3 years, Mark, before I could choose to go in whatever door I wanted to enter at one of the theaters in my town. That was 3 years before I could go into the dressing room of a department store and try on a suit of clothes rather than have to put the pants up to my waist and the jacket up to my shoulders. I could go on that way, but I remember that time so very well in that regard. Race relations were still quite strained. We were a very, very segregated society, and there was indeed a sense of apartheid, much like South Africa experienced for so many, many years. We never want people to forget that.
See, do you think that if not for Dr. King's influence, that there wouldn't be a Civil Rights Act of 1964 and a Voting Rights Act of 1965?
Well, it's hard for me to say because there were other key leaders, but he brought such energy and enthusiasm and I dare say commitment and uncommon courage that there came a point where people of goodwill and conscience felt compelled to do the right thing, from the leadership there in the White House to the leadership there in Congress. The time had come. Martin King really played a pivotal role in that, but I wouldn't say that it wouldn't have come anyhow.
Michael, what is the history of the Martin Luther King holiday? How long has it been around, and how did it get its start?
Well, the holiday concept emerged as African-Americans and others start thinking about the fact that there was no designated time to celebrate the legacy of African-American people. King became the person, the persona around which we were able to galvanize strength and the kind of political clout to make the holiday happen. To make the King holiday happen, you know, it became a state-by-state kind of celebration and not just a federal thing, because when the federal holiday was declared, a lot of states still did not celebrate the King holiday. So it was a long, long, long time before Arizona, for example, finally accepted that the holiday should be legitimized. What we focus on and what King has his family has focused on is that the holiday is a day for people to be actively engaged in community activity, not a day off, but a day on, which is what King's family often says, and which is what President Obama says today, that the King holiday is a day on for community activity, on for community organizing, on for serving the poor, on for doing projects that make us all better. That's what we accent in the King holiday, the legacy of remembering the person and the multiple personalities that made it possible. Can I go back to a point that Dr. Newsom referred to earlier about the King legacy and the fact that the legislation may have been passed, but would have taken a long, 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 long time without the personality of King and without the personality of Lyndon Baines Johnson. We have underestimated the strength of Lyndon Baines Johnson making sure that the legislation was in fact passed and that the kind of discrimination was made unlawful nationwide. This Southern Texas man took a mantle that was totally inconsistent with his background to fight strongly for civil rights. So King, Andy Young, Ralph Abernathy, and Lyndon Baines Johnson, far more than John F. Kennedy, are responsible for civil rights legislation.
What year did the holiday finally come about at the federal level? Was that the early 1980s?
It was in the 80s, yeah.
It was in the 80s, I'm sorry. I'll tell you now.
How tough was it to get it recognized at the national level?
It was extremely,
extremely difficult.
Yeah.
It took personalities, and who can mention King's holiday and what it took to get passed without referencing Stevie Wonder, who at times was engaged that people who worked with him in the music industry wondered where he was, and he was on point somewhere working for this holiday along with the King family, Jesse Jackson, and a host of others.
So
that was a good bit of opposition to it. You take someone like Jesse Hams, a senator from my home state, was very much opposed to it, saying that it would cost too much and that sort of thing. And yet, it was clear to a lot of people why he opposed it. It didn't have anything to do with money. It had to do with the kind of change that Martin Luther King Jr. personified and encouraged, and that we all need and really must have in our society even today.
In fact, I think I read somewhere somebody mentioned that the opposition was actually kind of a silver lining because it got the conversation going. It kind of exposed the other point
really
of view.
The opposition created what Hegel calls creative tension that's necessary for growth. It created the kind of tension that caused people to say, wait a minute, what King did was constitutionally sound. What King did was inviting America to fully realize its own dream and aspiration. So you had a large element of the white community as well as the black community across denominational lines, across every line, saying we ought to celebrate this man for what he did for the nation. Not just what he did for African-American people, but what he did for the nation. And I think we cannot lose the fact that King helped the nation, not just African-American people, but the nation.
Yeah, and I think it's important to say in that regard that celebrating Martin Luther King Jr. Day is a celebration of us as a nation. And I really want to press that point. It is not so much lifting a particular individual high and placing him on a pedestal. It's a summons for all of us to rise, to be the best of who we can be as a people. And it's a wonderful time for us to recognize what we can do when we come together. If we could live out the rest of the year in the way that we tend to come together on a Martin Luther King Jr. Day, we would be demonstrating to Martin King even now how his dream still lives and how it is materializing.
Do people take the holiday seriously enough, do you think?
Well, I think that many people do because it's celebrated. So in that regard, I would say yes. But, you know, every moment is a moment to educate. And even now, I should say to our listeners that this is not a day to be trivialized. A man gave his life for a nation of people who could, if they only seized the moment at hand, prosper more and in every way be more productive, be more family-oriented. If you really grabbed hold of his dream in full, you would see that Martin King, and this is how I characterize it, was more about leading a spiritual rights movement than he was a civil rights movement. It was about so much more than just getting voting legislation passed. It was really about how we live together wherever we are. And this is something that needs to be emphasized more and more.
We will continue our conversation on this Martin Luther King Day. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. My guest this afternoon, National Underground Railroad Freedom Center President Dr. C.G. Newsom and Executive Vice President and Provost Dr. Michael Battle. What kind of progress, C.G., have we made in race relations since the days of Martin Luther King Jr.?
Well, I think we have a number of benchmarks to highlight. Each year this time, we sort of take a census and a survey to see how far we've come. The number of black elected officials. And needless to say that the first African-American president is about to go out of office, but to have a person like that serving in the highest position in the land is a clear indication that we've made some progress on the racial front. And yet at the same time, there's so much afoot in the life of our nation that reminds us that we've perhaps progressed a few inches and we have many, many miles to go, particularly in the area of equal rights. Now, at the Freedom Center, we exist partly to talk about freedom with respect to equality. So we define freedom in terms of inclusive freedom, meaning all people enjoying rights and privileges of equal number, equal kind, and equal measure. So this still is before us, and this is sort of what Martin King really had in mind, living this kind of freedom. We've got a long ways to go, but if we keep moving in the right direction and pressing towards the mark, we will realize this vision of his, which is a vision for the nation.
It's like a lot of things in life, isn't it, CG? Nothing ever moves up in a straight line.
Oh, it never happens that way. No need to look for it. But you have to stay the course.
Michael, how do you view the state of relations today?
Well, you can look at a lot of individual instances that validates that we have made a lot of progress. And then you can look at a lot of individual instances that show that there is an intense growing effort to slow things down. I think individually, on a one-on-one basis, people get along with each other a whole lot better than the collective institutionalized racism that we see in our nation. If you isolate a white person and a black person in conversation one-on-one, they will find that there's far more in common with one another than difference. However, when you start stacking up the institutional systems, like those systems that prohibit people from getting jobs and from progressing, President Obama made a statement at the funeral in Charleston, South Carolina. Why is it the case that Johnny gets a second call for an interview, but a name like Jamal often doesn't get a second call for an interview? Very often, that's more an institutional setting that prohibits that than it is a one-on-one individual designation of racism. If we were to listen to the spiritual call of King, that all of us live on a higher plane, recognize our commonality, I think as a nation we would be a whole lot better than we are now. We've come a long way, but God knows we have a long, long way to go.
And I think we have, in particular, to press our way forward against the fear that we have for change and positive change. When we begin to really get beyond fearing what we can bring forth as a nation in terms of good things for all of us, we'll begin to see Martin King's dream really flourish in all of our lives. We must not fear the change that he called for.
Michael, we heard C.G.'s view on the election of President Obama, first African-American president. I'm interested to know how you characterize his election and the effects it's had on race relations.
Well, now I have to do an honest admission. I worked on his campaign ever since I supported him when he was a state senator in Illinois. I supported him when he became the U.S. Senator for Illinois. And when his campaign started, I was one of the early persons called and was on weekly calls about his campaign. So I'm biased. But what was the most essential point in the campaign, I think, in the first campaign was when myself and a group of other people were sent into South Carolina to assure that he won the South Carolina primary. Because we knew that had he not won the South Carolina primary, he never would have been elected as president. That was the key pivotal primary. He had done well in predominantly white states. He had never done well in a state that had a very large black vote. And so our job was to go in and bring South Carolina on board. And so we did. So I'm very biased. I served as an ambassador for 4 years under his administration and as a senior advisor to the State Department for 1 year under his administration. So I'm very biased. I think his election did more than just a boost for African Americans, however. It represented a change in the American thought pattern where people were saying, let us elect this man.
Was it a big turning point for our country?
It was a big potential turning point for our country. I think we as a nation dropped the opportunity. You know, early on before he was inaugurated, President Obama was invited by a large group of conservative people, George Will's among them, to come to George Will's house for a discussion about what he planned to do. And he had that discussion, but unfortunately, instead of people working with him, there was a determination, well, we know what he wants to do, now let's make sure he is a one-term president. And that became the mantra, as opposed to accepting an olive branch as an opportunity to work together, it became an opportunity to learn what his strategies were and then to do everything to prevent him from being successful. But fortunately, he has had the second term and has been successful on so many levels in this nation. Lowest unemployment rate we've had in a long time. The economy is doing a whole lot better than the naysayers are saying that it is doing. We have a lot of progress to make, but we have made phenomenal progress.
CG, Gallup's been tracking the issue of race since 1963, and in January 2014, 55% of all the Americans who were surveyed said they were very or somewhat satisfied with the state of race relations. A year later, it had dropped to 30% of respondents. And of course, during 2014, that was a year that marked that we had it marked by many racial conflicts. Ferguson, Missouri, comes to mind as being the big example there. How should we view that seeming slump in race relations that Gallup is reflecting?
Well, I think what the Gallup pollsters put their hands on has been a tension that has been with us throughout decades. And at any point in time, wherever you touch that tension, you will get one reading or another. The point is, it's real. Sometimes it registers higher, sometimes registers lower. Going into, you know, another election cycle is part of that. But relations between African Americans and police departments all over the country have been problems for years. This is really nothing new. It really isn't. When I think back to my own youth, I remember getting those lectures about how to handle myself anytime I saw a policeman in public. I remember even now, just a year before last, visiting my oldest daughter in a southern city, deciding to go out for a walk late at night, having her express fear that I would take a walk by myself in her neighborhood. And I said, I'm in a gated community. And she said, that's precisely the problem. They don't see a whole lot of you in this community, and I'm afraid that someone might call the police. That bothered me. Well, it's that kind of tension and uneasiness that's with us, and we need to continue to get to the point where race is about as important as the color of a person's eyes.
Well, thank you for joining me today, CG and Michael.
Thank you.
Thank you.
National Underground Railroad Freedom Center President Dr. Clarence Newsom and Executive Vice President and Provost, Dr. Michael Battle. Coming up, we'll talk with Marion Spencer about her life and legacy as a civil rights leader. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.